Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know?
Yes, we did. We started to burn many, many things we found. This is back to the... We are back at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman. Glad to be with you for another scintillating hour here. On the radio, we have two topics we're going to talk about today. We start off with nuclear power. Major leak at the Hanford Reservation. That's not an Indian reservation, by the way. It's a reservation filled with horrible tanks filled with the most contaminated nuclear stuff you could ever imagine. We have new leaks to report at this ridiculous place, and we're going to be joined in a moment or two by Robert Alvarez. Bob, are you there? Not yet. He's going to be with us, talking to us from Tacoma Park, Maryland. And we are also, in the second half hour, we're going to be joined by Shel Horowitz and Bill Jacobson, who are going to talk to us about a totally different kind of reservation, a beautiful former hippie farm in western Massachusetts. And we're going to talk about green marketing and the ongoing realities of communal farming and what has happened to those late 60s communes that were so much fun, and where there is one of them now that's actually still in existence and will be open and available to the public in the near future. We're going to talk about that in the second half of our show. We're waiting for Bob Alvarez to join us. Bob is one of the great experts in nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I have co-authored a book with Bob called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, which is up, and it's actually free on the Internet to anyone who wants to download it. Again, it's called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, and my co-author Bob Alvarez is going to be with us. In the meantime, let me talk to you briefly about what has happened in the Hanford, Washington reservation in upstate, it's in the western eastern part of the state of Washington, actually. It has a huge farm of tanks filled with the worst substances ever known to man, and it is leaking. It's been reported in numerous places, including the Huffington Post now, that these leaks are getting more and more serious. There are 177 underground tanks at the site. This is in today's Huffington Post, by the way. And monitoring wells near the tank have not detected high radiation levels, but Jay Inslee, who is the governor of the state of Washington, said there's a leak there in the range of 150 gallons to 300 gallons in the course of a year, which is a long-term threat to the groundwater and the rivers, especially the Columbia River in Washington State, which runs between Washington and Oregon. And the Hanford has been one of the big weapons production facilities dating back to the Manhattan Project in the 1940s. And there was a huge amount of radioactive material that's been stored there, and that is with no place to go, and leaking all over the place, and it's a very, very dangerous situation. Here's what Jay Inslee said at a news conference, the governor of Washington. I am alarmed about this on many, many levels. This raises concerns not only about the existing leak, but also concerning the integrity of the other single-shell tanks of this age. Now, these tanks were established in the 1940s. to contain the huge quantities of highly radioactive liquid waste that was created with the production of the atomic bomb. And we are now witnessing leaks there that could go, well, they're on their way to the Columbia River that could permanently contaminate it. Do we have Bob Alvarez on the line yet?
On the phone.
Oh, there you are, Bob. You're just letting me rant and rant and
yeah,
go on
that's
here.
Okay. Sounds
so,
interesting to me.
Bob Alvarez, you have been, and we're talking with one of the great experts in the world, certainly one of the top 10 people who knows anything the most about the Hanford weapons site. Bob, you were the lead staff person for Senator John Glenn's committee way back when, and you are now the senior scholar of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. The reports about this tank, one particular tank in question, we're not talking about tanks that drive and shoot people, these are big storage tanks, has 447,000 gallons of sludge, a mixture of solids and liquids with a mud-like consistency, built in the 1940s, known to have leaked in the past, stabilized in 1995. But now they're saying that the governor is saying that it's been documented to be losing liquids since all the Hanford tanks were stabilized or allegedly stabilized in 2005. What can you tell us about this?
Well, these tanks, for the most part, are larger than the Washington State Capitol Dome. They're underground tanks, and there have been at least, this makes 69 tanks that have leaked out of the 177, so that would be...
Almost half.
Basically, nearly 40% of the tanks have leaked out there. They've leaked over 1 million gallons of radioactive material into the ground, which is creeping towards the groundwater that enters the Columbia River about 10 miles away. These tanks, as you point out, were constructed in mostly in the 1940s and through the mid 1960s, and they stopped using them by the mid to late 1960s and just sort of walked away from them without any regard for removing the contents or stabilizing them for any form of long-term disposal. The tanks also generate, especially when you add water to them, they generate flammable and explosive gases in the form of hydrogen, and depending on the chemicals that were put in there, sometimes they would put in solvents and things like that that they were using in the process of making plutonium, and that generates organic gases which can blow up, and they also put in other types of chemicals that have raised concern about the potential for tank explosions and fires. So when you start to move these wastes around, they have pumped out as much of the liquids as they can. And
but
so
where do they pump it to? I mean, you pump out these tanks, it doesn't magically disappear in outer space.
Well, they run them through evaporators.
Well, that's exciting.
Then the evaporators sort of capture, let's say most of the radioactive materials, and they dump the resins back in the tank. So they have been pumped. They've pumped as much liquid as they can out of these single shell tanks. But in order to remove those wastes and stabilize them, and the current plan is to mix them with molten glass and put them into glass logs for ultimate disposal, you have to add water. Once you start to do that, what happens is that the radiation interacts with the water. It's called radiolysis, and it basically peels the hydrogen off the water. The H2O water molecule and starts to propagate this hydrogen gas. So throughout the process of removing this stuff, running it through pipes, running it through this plant that's going to mix it with glass, you've got to be concerned about pipes plugging and hydrogen explosions. So one of the tanks, which is a newer tank, it was called 101SY, in the 1970s and 80s, it actually went into service in the 1970s, and they put a whole bunch of organic materials in there in the form of solvents, and it formed a very thick crust on top of the tank. This is a million-gallon tank, so this is even twice as large as the one that's in the news in terms of the tea farm tank. It formed a large crust on top, and underneath this gas was just generating, and it created this huge bubble, which caused what they call a buoyant displacement, caused this giant crust on top, which weighed many, many tons, to roll over, and then a huge amount of gas, explosive hydrogen gas, would burst out into the headspace of the tank, and it could have been very, very serious. And these problems for many years had been simply swept under the carpet and covered up until really the late 80s, early 90s, when we started to investigate this while I worked in the Senate.
Unbelievable stuff. It's really unbelievable. And so you're saying there are 177 tanks like this?
There are 177 tanks at Hanford. The Department of Energy has a total of about 200 of these tanks.
And you're talking millions and millions of gallons of either liquid or
there are about
54 sludge.
Million gallons of high-level radioactive waste at Hanford. There are about 32 million gallons at the Savannah River site. And
in South Carolina.
In South Carolina. And there's a smaller batch, I don't remember, at the Idaho site.
INEL, Idaho National Engineering
that's
Lab.
That's correct. And see, these wastes are basically are wastes that resulted from reprocessing. That is to say that what they did is that they had these reactors at Hanford, several of them, numerous, 9 or 10 operating, where they irradiated the uranium in order to generate plutonium, about 1% of the radioactive materials that are generated once you irradiate the uranium is plutonium. So they would take the spent fuel and ultimately take it to a reprocessing plant. They had 3 of them operating there over periods of many years. And they would drop the spent fuel into nitric acid and dissolve it, and then run it through a process where they would extract the plutonium and the uranium using solvents, and then the waste that would come out as a nitric acid. And during World War II, when they first started to do this, there was a shortage of stainless steel. So the DuPont Corporation, which was the company that was contracted by the government to sort of set all this up, worked around it by deciding that they could use cheaper carbon steel tanks if they added a bunch of water and sodium hydroxide, otherwise known as lye, to neutralize the waste. And so what this did is that it added a tremendous amount of volume and water to the waste, and also made the waste much more difficult to handle. And that what you have is, you know, you have the heaviest stuff sitting on the bottom, the lighter stuff sitting in salt, and sometimes with a liquid level on top. And they never thought about what it would take to deal with these wastes, because it was never considered part of the overall mission. They always had this attitude of, well, we've got to make all this plutonium as quickly as possible, and we'll have someone else worry about these wastes later. And so by the time that plutonium production pretty much was curtailed at Hanford...
When was that bomb?
In the mid-1960s. They still made some plutonium, but they really sharply curtailed it, and these production reactors were all closed except for one in 1970. They pretty much walked away from these tanks and hoped that no one would
notice 177 tanks with 54 million gallons.
Well, there's 149 of them that are these so-called single-shell tanks. They have this, and there are the remainder are double shell. These were more durable tanks that they have out there. And so when they walked away from this, it was sort of one of these decisions made by a bureaucracy in secrecy and isolation that they would just leave it there and it would be disposed of in place. And that had been the plan that was carried through the years, by the Atomic Energy Commission, Then it was abolished in the mid-1970s, and ultimately we had the Energy Department. And until the 1990, the Department of Energy's plan was just to leave that stuff in those tanks and let them sit there and leak away and rot away, and, you know, until we and others, Senator John Glenn in particular, to his credit, began to raise some serious doubts and concerns about the advisability of doing that.
Right, and then now there's a plan to build a 12 a plant in excess of $12 billion to convert these materials to something more stable. Is that correct?
Well, that's the cost for the construction, and it's bound to go up. But if you look at the life cycle expense, in other words, the cost of constructing and operating and then dealing with whatever is left over as radioactive waste, once you remove the, once you process these wastes, the life cycle cost is currently around $70 billion.
Ah, now this is $70 billion. So this is 70 billion, and this is stuff just to deal with stuff from making the nuclear bombs.
Yeah, this is the largest, most expensive and riskiest nuclear project and environmental cleanup project ever undertaken in the United States.
Well, probably in the world. I mean, no one else is dealing with it on this scale.
No, not at all. And the problem is with these wastes is that it's a witch's brew of chemicals and radioactive materials, and that they haven't, you know, it costs a tremendous amount of money just to try to figure out what's in them. Every time you have to do a sample, it costs about $1 million to analyze a sample, and you can't, you know, only so many samples you can take. So technologically, it's kind of the same challenge as sending humans to the moon, except there's no moon here.
Well, yeah, the moon is going to be what the Earth is going to look like when these things blow. Is there a chance that any of these things could explode?
Well, there's always that risk, and you have to keep an eye on these tanks because they're constantly venting gases. And as I said, once you start to get serious about removing these wastes, you have to start adding water, and then you have a hydrogen problem that immediately, becomes a concern. So the risk of these tanks, you know, of explosive flammable gases accumulating in the head spaces of these tanks, these giant underground tanks, is always there, and you've got to constantly monitor for that.
All right, Jesus. We are talking with Bob Alvarez about one of the most astonishing environmental disasters in progress on the face of the earth. No one's listening to it, but the governor of Washington State has now taken, Jay Inslee has taken some mind to it. Bob, what's prompted this latest round of interest in Hanford?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been Hanford's has had a continuous difficulty, to put it mildly, in trying to get this waste treatment plant up and running, because it's a first of a kind operation involving materials that they really don't have an adequate understanding of. And it's a high hazard facility, and instead of doing, you know, what normally should be done, which is you build a smaller pilot plant to see what will work, they're doing what's called design build. They're simultaneously designing and building a first of a kind high hazard nuclear facility.
Oh my God.
Without any clear clue of how it would work. When I worked in the Energy Department, I used to refer to this as the ready, shoot, aim approach to dealing with this problem. And it's an unfortunate way to proceed, because we shouldn't be doing this that way. But there's been so much pressure put on the department to, you know, get this job done, and they have lost sight of I think some basic common sense things, that this project, because it's a first of a kind, because of the extreme, the extraordinary conservatism you have to apply to things like safety at this plant, you can't make any mistakes, and you have to do this very carefully. I wrote a paper in 2005 about Hanford that appeared in a journal published at Princeton called Science and Global Security. And what I did in that paper was sort of recount how a large part of this had to do with what, you know, describing what these wastes are about and what has been done to assess the efforts to try to stabilize the wastes. And when I worked in the Department of Energy, we decided to bring the Nuclear Regulatory Commission into the picture. The Department of Energy is self-regulating, and it regulates nuclear safety basically through contract clauses. So it's a real problem because a contractor can go to the department or to the federal official at the site and say, well, you know, we're going to miss our schedule and we're going to be off budget if we have to comply with this clause. So why don't you give us a little leeway? So they can make these changes without any public notice. Whereas the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for all the criticism that's been leveled at it, it does operate under much more transparent safety standards. The standards are promulgated through the Administrative Procedures Act. They're legally binding. They have fines and penalties assigned to them. And they provide a certain degree they provide certainty in terms of here are the rules, here are where the lines are drawn, and you shouldn't be moving the lines and the goalposts. So we brought the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1997, and they brought in 75 people, which is, you know, quite a crew to bring in to deal with this project. And by 2001, after the George W. Bush administration was installed in office, they promptly showed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission the door.
And they didn't want even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is infamously in the pocket of the industry, was too stringent for the people who are...
Well, what was interesting about the NRC in this situation is that unlike the reactor industry where they have this sort of unfortunate codependent relationship, they really didn't have a dog in the hunt, as they say, with the DOE. You know, this was a facility where, you know, they were assigned to sort of license the melter, and they took it very seriously. So when they were told to leave, they issued a closeout report, which apparently wasn't read by very many people, especially in the Department of Energy. And when I took a look at this report, I was astonished. Among the things that they pointed out about this plant is that at the time that they left, that they estimated that this plant had a 50-50 chance of experiencing a catastrophic radiation accident during the operation of the facility.
And the catastrophic accident at Hanford with that material would essentially equate to an apocalypse. I mean, can you describe?
Well, I mean, what the NRC pointed out is that this facility should be regulated as if it were a nuclear power plant. And unlike a nuclear power plant, it doesn't have that thick barrier or containment over the reactor core, or in this case, over the melters.
So any one of these 149 single-shell tanks at Hanford is capable of a dispersal of radioactive materials on a par with Fukushima?
Well, not quite, but the melters might. If they have an explosion in the melters, they could have a very large release of radioactivity. So what is between the radioactive material and the process of this plant and people in the environment are filters. And there are hundreds and hundreds of filters that they have to rely on. This is a very complicated operation. And so, for example, if there were, you know, there are volcanoes that occasionally erupt out there, and there's a lot of ash that sometimes deposits. And if the ash deposits on these filters, you have to change them out real fast if this plant is operating. And so there are a lot of things that people hadn't thought about.
Well, so Bob Alvarez, we're talking with Robert Alvarez. We're just almost out of time, Bob. I'm going to have you back because this is just beyond belief. We're talking about the Hanford Nuclear Facility in the eastern part of Washington State, where the governor has just expressed some serious fear about what could happen there. We're talking about radioactive waste that were accumulated during the Manhattan Project in the 1940s. right?
Well, from the 1940s through the 1970s and 80s.
So, right, and so, you know, decades ago, we have 177 tanks, 149 of them single shell, 54 million gallons of incredibly radioactive materials with the potential, each one, are you saying each one of these single shell plants could be, well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, each one of these single shell plants could give us an accident on the par of a nuclear power plant?
No, what they said was that the tanks had the risk of explosions and fires, and they didn't quantify how bad they would be. What the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did say is that the plant that's supposed to stabilize these wastes can have an accident on par of that of a major reactor.
Okay, and then the plant that's supposed to stabilize these, which is currently listed at $12.3 billion, but which you say could cost much, much more, is still in progress, not completed. When is it supposed to be finished?
Well, that we don't know, because the schedule has continued to slip. And right now, I think we're looking, you know, assuming this plant can be put back on, it can be put back on track, and let's assume that it can be operational and they don't have any problems, you're looking probably at a 40 to 50 year time frame before all this stuff can be processed.
Oh, my God. So Bob Alvarez, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, a longtime cohort of mine, co-author of Killing Our Own, which is available free on the Internet. Give us a summary statement here in 2 minutes of the scope of this problem here. I mean, you got material leaking towards the Columbia River. You have stuff we have no idea what to do with. A current estimate of $70 billion, and these are materials that had to do with the nuclear weapons industry.
I think that what we're dealing with, and what people don't appreciate, is that this is the largest, most expensive, complicated, and risky nuclear and environmental cleanup project we've ever undertaken. And it's comparable to, you know, in terms of the risks and the complexity and everything else, to the space shuttle or sending people to the moon. And yet it's being treated as some sort of out-of-the-way project. This is a project of huge national importance because these wastes have the potential of threatening one of the largest rivers in America.
The Columbia River.
The Columbia River.
And it's only 10 miles from the Columbia River.
That's right. And so I can understand why the governor of Washington State is upset about the turn of events out there, because that river is the lifeblood of the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, my God. And we've already had materials leaking and threatening the water table that leaks into that feeds into the Columbia River.
Right.
And so we've actually had contamination from
the answer. There are other things maybe we can get into later. I mean, I wrote a paper in 2010 that pointed out that they have perhaps as much as a ton of plutonium dumped in the ground out there.
Oh, my God. A ton of plutonium would be...
And they really don't have much intention of removing it, and that's something we have to be concerned about. This is, you know, we're dealing with problems that go on and on and on, and we can't sort of... just forget about them and make our decisions based on employees who are thinking about when they're eligible for retirement.
we'll have three or four generations of employees who are eligible for retirement before this is dealt with at all. I mean, this is unbelievable. Robert Alvarez, you are always an inspiration. You were the inspiration for Killing Our Own. And I'm going to have you back for another a session full of laughs and entertainment about the nuclear weapons industry. And we'll have to talk about the nuclear power industry, too, which is in rapid decline. Bob, do you have a book or a website that you can guide people to?
People can go to the Institute for Policy Studies, www.ips-dc.org.
All right.
Look up the nuclear policy, and you'll find a whole bunch of my papers.
All right, Bob. Well, we'll definitely have you back, because nobody knows more about this stuff than you do. Thank you so much for enlightening us on the Hanford Nuclear Facility in the news today for leaking and freaking out the governor of Washington State, not to mention all the people in the great Northwest. Bob, a pleasure to have you. We'll be back in a couple minutes after the break to talk about green marketing and Montague Farm, one of the great hippie institutions of the 1960s, which is being reincarnated yet again.
Fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour. Clean air, water, plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
We are back at Solartopia here after a scintillating half hour talking about the incredible catastrophe at the Hanford Nuclear Weapons Facility, where we have 177 tanks filled with 54 million gallons of high-level radiation, radioactive waste. Nobody knows what to do with Robert Alvarez, my co-author, on a book called Killing Our Own, which you can pick up off the Internet for free. Just Google Killing Our Own and download it. Having a hefty supply of Prozac nearby, as it is an amazingly depressing situation. The Hanford tanks are in the news today and the past couple of days because leaks there have freaked out the governor of the state of Washington, who wants something done about it. And please tune in if you haven't, if you missed it, to hear what Bob Alvarez of the Institute for Policy Studies has to say. We're going to thankfully turn it on a lighter note to a farm in western Massachusetts and a method of green marketing. We've got Bill Jacobson, the owner, or co-owner with his wife, of Montague Farm, where I had the incredible joy and honor to live from 1968 to 1983 or 4. Bill, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And Shel Horowitz, you there?
I certainly am, and by the way, I am a huge fan of at least three aspects of your work: the safe energy, the people's history stuff, and, of course, the voting rights.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate that. It's good to have a fan out there. I'm glad I got one.
I'm sure you've got more than one.
Well, anyway, let's start the show. I promise you, and we will talk about green marketing, but I want to start with something that is almost as dear to my heart as my children, which is Montague Farm. Montague Farm was founded in 1968 in western Massachusetts. It is one, and it's worthy of radio coverage, and among other things, because it's one of the very, very few of the late 1960s communes, of which there are many hundreds, that has survived intact. Bill, you are the third generation owner now of Montague Farm since it became a hippie farm. It went to, in 2003, it went to the Peacemaker, the Zen Peacemaker organization, having survived 35 years, amazingly enough, in the same hands of the people when it was originally started in 1968. It went to Bernie Glassman and Eve Marco and the Zen Peacemaker organization. They put a ton of money into the place and thankfully saved an old barn, a very old barn, a very big barn, which is now, well, you can tell us about it, and the house there. And now you have become the third generation owner. And tell us what your plans are for this magnificent 35-acre, incredibly beautiful, God love it, farm in western Massachusetts.
Well, I really came into this on a just totally by accident. I called my lawyer, asked him to look into another property for me, and he said, why don't you buy the Zendo? And I said, what Zendo? And I went down there and took a look and immediately fell in love with the place. As you say, it's stunningly beautiful. And I just had the sense that this place is very special and could and should be a place where lots of people do lots of important work, especially spiritual, artistic, and in the whole activism world, and that would create both local community and contribute to social and political change in the long run. So this is much more than a business proposition to me. I had to put most of my personal wealth into it, so I had to keep it, you know, privately owned for now, but my goal is definitely to return this place to public ownership through a nonprofit, which we formed on the day I purchased it. And I would invite people like you, Harvey, to be on the board of that institution if and when this can happen. The only thing in the way is money, and it's really a question of fixing up the facility We very carefully went to the town and you know, made a persuasive presentation, and were given permission to do a number of different activities that weren't previously allowed, including private functions, corporate retreats, and cultural events. The zoning was educational or religious. And then we also got permission to put in 62 beds because, as you say, peacemakers put an enormous amount into this facility, including a state-of-the-art commercial water system. So the water system is completely there, including a sprinkler system for both the barn and the farmhouse. But there's not a single code-compliant bed as of now, and there's only a half-finished commercial kitchen. So those are the main investments, and we have a building program that will go through 2016 to put in these 62 beds, of which 54 will be guest beds. And we hope to be open as early as this fall with 20 beds in the barn.
And what are we going to do at Montague Farm? This is a generic story in a way, but it's a story of what has happened to one of the great hippie farms of the late 1960s. This is the place where one of the first articles about organic farming was written. Robert Rodale visited Montague Farm and put an article about it in his Organic Gardening and Farming magazine in 1970, I believe. And then in 1973, we became a part of the anti-nuclear movement. Sam Lovejoy knocked over a 500-foot weather tower, and we coined the phrase "no nukes." And everything's gone from there. So what is it that you are going to do now with this incredibly rich history and beautiful facility to forward this legacy?
Well, I was going to say that educational and religious use will be our mainstay, things like meditation, yoga, workshops to promote activist causes. Music should be a big draw because of the history with Muse, which you could probably go into better than I. Rumor has it Jackson Browne and Bonnie Raitt visited the farm around the time of the No Nukes concerts. I'm not sure if that's just a rumor. But in any case, that'll be the mainstay. These other things like weddings, you know, the private functions, the corporate retreats, those are more to make ends meet so that we can dig our way we're not really in a financial hole at all. We haven't taken on any debt as of yet, but we would have to take on lots and lots of debt if we weren't able to sort of do this slowly and get lots of support from the community in terms of rentals.
So Horowitz, tell us about marketing a place like this and how you would put it in the public eye.
Okay. Well, Bill and I met actually at a celebration for the publication of Tom Fels's book about living on the farm. So this is all very serendipitous, and then you and I had already talked about having me on the show, so we brought Bill in as well. But he hired me to write a marketing plan, and I, you know, when I got there to see the place, which they've already done a lot to make it really gorgeous, by the way, I got there and I turned to Bill and I said, you know, this is sacred ground to me. Because not only was your book, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, written there, but a lot of the work around the huge No Nukes book that came out in 1977 and which I used extensively in writing my No Nukes book a couple of years later, that was written there. Sam Lovejoy, of course, toppled the tower while he lived there. Lionel Delavagne, who took many of the photographs of the Seabrook occupation, was connected with that community. It was a very special thing, and in doing the marketing plan for the farm, I really looked at how can we use this heritage, this incredible history, to bring in these rentals, these events that Bill wants to have there. And so we're looking at who are the people that would want to celebrate in a place where so much has contributed to the movement. And there's a long list. You know, I sent him many, many pages of ideas. And
it was a very impressive plan, I have to say. And I'd like to add that the place is so stunningly beautiful, not just the barn, but the land, the setting, the fact that it's surrounded by two rivers which come to a confluence right below the barn, that, you know, if we can stay competitive price-wise, which I think we can, very competitive, that the place, you know, should be attractive to people. But
Well, what role in the year 20... What year are we? 2013. Year.
2013.
That's a symptom of having lived on a hippie farm. There were days and weeks and months at the farm when I didn't know what day it was, what month it was. What, you know, I mean, we just lived in a whole other world. And, you know, my slogan about Montague Farm is it was paradise, even when it wasn't. So, tell me, what in this day and age, we've got an ancient hippie farm. It's incredibly beautiful. It's been rehabbed, and the barn has been preserved. The original barn, by the way, was built in 1799. And then there was
actually 1894. Harvey, 1894 for the barn and the original part of the farmhouse.
Yes,
so
1894. And then when was the house built?
1798, the original part, and then the main part was brought over by oxen from Shutesbury in 1900.
Yeah, so this is an old place, but, you know, more than $1 million was poured into this place. I don't know how many other hippie farms can say that, and the barn is solarized. It's astonishing. It's beautiful. I mean, anybody who wants to take a pilgrimage should do so, and then the house has been preserved. So here we are. We're talking about a legacy from 1968 that's still with us. What do we do with what is the function of a place like this in today's world? Shell or Bill, take it away.
Well, it's funny because actually I live in what may be the oldest solar home in the United States. We solarized a house back in 2001 that was built in 1743, so even older than the original building of the Montague Farm. But I think it's really important to remember our history and to celebrate our history and to remember that it wasn't all just about battles on battlefields and generals and politicians, that there was a strong tradition of history of the people. That this is an important place in terms of the safe energy movement. I mean, let's face it, we actually won. You know, how rare is it for progressives to win? From 1907, when did Seabrook go online finally? 80, 81, somewhere
89.
Around there?
Well, we were involved in going up from Montague Farm up to help with the organizing of the Seabrook nuclear plant. It's beginning in 1976 or 75. In 1973, the local utility said they wanted to build a nuclear plant 4 miles from Montague Farm, and we weren't given a snowball's chance of stopping them, and by God, we did. And the
you
place
sure did,
where they,
and
the
thank
place,
you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And the place where they wanted to build that nuclear plant is now a nature conservancy. And so you can walk 4 miles, you can walk an hour and a half from Montague Farm to and lie down on the ground at the place where they were going to build a nuclear plant, look up at the sky, and it's a nature preserve. And, you know, we did that. And since that time, back then Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear plants.
1,000 nuclear power plants. But Seabrook was the last one to go online. 104, Seabrook was the last one. I was arrested at Seabrook, and I was really sad the day that it got turned on. But, yeah, we lost that one battle, but we actually, for 30 years, we have kept any more nuclear power plants from being built. We have to fight that battle again. I thought we'd kind of done with it, but...
I'd like to add that for me, it's even bigger than safe energy, which is big enough. It's just the entire counterculture, because the original group that came up to the farm, that bought the farm, as you know well, Harvey, were the more new age wing of Liberation News Service, which was supplying the college campuses around the country with another way to look at what was going on at the time. And it's an entire way of, you know, it's really a rejection of a lifestyle, and a lifestyle that implied a lot of use of a lot of resources. You know,
right.
How might we live a little more simply and more peacefully and with values that, you know, with more compassion and more awareness of the impact of what we're doing on, you know, in the world.
Yes, and I got to say, you know, at Montague Farm, I lived there all those years and was involved with all those people, and we, as any family will, we fought tooth and nail. There was never an act of violence at Montague Farm. I never, ever saw anybody hit or even think about hitting anybody else. We had no guns. It was, you know, an incredibly, and continues to be, an incredibly peaceful environment. I do want to make one suggestion. I know you'll love this one. The Liberation News Service, as we found out in the 1970s, was broken up by the in part by the FBI. We
right.
were infiltrated, and their goal was not to supply information, but rather to destroy the news service. And there was a memo written by J. Edgar Hoover, or to J. Edgar Hoover, which he handwrote some notes on. And had the FBI not infiltrated Liberation News Service, we would not have run away from New York City, and Montague Farm would not have been started. And so as you proceed with Montague Farm, I would like to strongly suggest that you put up a plaque to J. Edgar Hoover somewhere on the site, so that, you know, thanking him for helping us start this hippie farm that in turn helped start the organic farming movement and the anti-nuclear movement. I'm sure that would prompt him to spin in his grave, and that would be certainly worthwhile. So
maybe right next to some kind of homage to Marshall Bloom.
Yes, Marshall, of course, was the founder of Liberation News Service with Ray Mungo and a few others of us, and then became the founder of Montague Farm. And talk about thinking out of the box. I mean, I knew Marshall in high school and a little bit, and he for Marshall Bloom, the box never existed. And so Montague Farm was started by a decision to take a New York-based radical news service and move it in the dead of night, although actually we did it in the daytime, to a farm in western Massachusetts. And here we are all these years later, 35 years later, and we're still there, for God's sakes. It's amazing.
Mm. Well, my sense was that this place shouldn't be broken up. It needs to stay physically in one piece, and that's, you know, a lot of what drove me to do it, you know, to step in and take the business risk I'm taking here. But, you know, it was cheap, and it's gorgeous, and I really think that it can serve people. I think all sorts of, you know, I think without being able to stay overnight, it's tough to do serious work there. But as soon as you can stay overnight, you know, weekend retreats, week-long retreats, there's all kinds of wonderful things that can come out of it.
Well, Shell, tell us how you're going to market this and let the public know about the possibilities.
Actually, Shell, let me just say before you say that our website isn't quite up yet, so you can't find us by going to www.montagueretreatcenter.com yet, although it will be up soon. For now, you have to go on Facebook and search for Montague Retreat Center with the spaces in between the words.
So, Shell, what's going to happen with how are we going to let the public know about when do you expect Montague Farm to be online, ready for people to greet people?
Well, I think the website should be up within a month, and we should be ready to start business in September or October of this year.
And what will business consist of? You're going to have retreats, you're going to have,
retreats, some private functions and corporate retreats mixed in, hopefully green corporate. Some cultural events like concerts and plays, and all the familiar stuff, meditation, yoga, Pilates, healing arts, quilt making, you know, you name it. There's people do retreats in absolutely everything, I'm finding out.
Sounds fantastic. Shell, as opposed to retreating, how are you going to attack and let the public know? And tell us a bit about green marketing and what you
sure.
do.
Well, green marketing, I've been in the marketing world and the green world since the early 1970s, and for about the last dozen years I've been able to combine them. In fact, what really enabled me to see how they work together was here in western Massachusetts, where I also live. I'm sure, Harvey, you're familiar with the Mount Holyoke Range. There was a developer who decided that the Mount Holyoke Range was the perfect place to put 40 McMansions, and all the experts said, oh, this is terrible, there's nothing we can do, and being an old activist type, I don't know, what do you mean there's nothing we can do? So my wife and I organized a movement, and we called it Save the Mountain, and within 13 months, I had actually figured it would take 5 years, but it only took us 13 months to knock this from 40 houses going all the way up the ridgetop to two at the bottom, which I think was appropriate for the site. So that really used everything I know about community organizing and everything I know about marketing and a lot of other skills that a lot of other people brought to the table, and stuff that I didn't know about, like lobbying, endangered species work and all the rest of it. So having ridden that success, I thought, well, gee, if I can do marketing for the things, the causes that I'm passionate about, the businesses that I love, maybe there's a career in there for me. So I wrote the first of two books on green and ethical marketing. It was called Principal Profit. I had to take it out of print when the second one came out, which is Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green, which I co-authored with J. Conrad Levinson, whose name is on all the guerrilla marketing books. And, you know, there's basically a few different things going on with green marketing. First of all, it's nice to be ahead of the curve and have the curve catch up. The world is suddenly focused on green issues in a way that it never has been in my 40-plus years of doing this work. And that is really exciting. Of course,
we're close to the end here. Can you give us, what is the essence of green marketing? Tell us what the core of it is.
Well, the core is that if you're marketing to people who are not necessarily green, you say, this is going to be better, cheaper, more luxurious, more comfortable, more durable, whatever, because of the green stuff you have in there. And if you're marketing to the green market, of course, you talk about how this is going to be better for the earth and all, you know, the good groovy things that we all talk about. In Bill's case, I suggested that a lot of the momentum he needs to build could be done by word of mouth in having various types of communities come together in open houses, and that would be one strategy that I was suggesting that he use, that to bring people in the door, let them experience the place, and really have it spiral out. Because in his case, it's going to be, I'd say at least at first, it's probably going to be 50 or 60% mostly local market.
But what is the difference between green marketing and the regular marketing we get from the corporations?
Well, among other things, it's going to be a lot more honest and a lot less hard sell.
How about you're going to use hard HEART as opposed to hard HARD?
There we go.
Yes,
there
exactly.
Go.
Okay.
And it's going to respect people's intelligence, which conventional marketing doesn't always.
Okay, that's fair.
And Harvey, just allowing us on your show is a huge benefit to us, because a lot of people just hear the name for the first time and maybe they'll be curious enough to go and take a look at some pictures, you know?
Right. Well, it's an incredibly gorgeous place. Montague Hippie Farm, the old Liberation News Service farm. And we're down to 2 minutes. Bill, give us a minute, please, and Shell a minute of the core of what you want to tell people.
Well, I just like to leave people with the notion that we have these, that Zen Peacemakers put in these wonderful pits, geothermal pits, 5 of them, enough capacity for 2 heat pumps. So if you have your event and it's sweltering hot, we will be able to keep you cool in the barn for almost zero electricity, most of which is generated by our own solar.
Wonderful. Fantastic. And Shell Horowitz, what do you want to tell us going out the door here about green marketing and Montague Farm and the future of all this?
Well, there's number one, the Montague Farm is also surrounded by Nature Conservancy land, which is really good. And number two, unlike Bill, I do have a website, and it's green and profitable, and is spelled out, .com, greenandprofitable.com. And you can find information there about the book, Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green, about the marketing support I can give to green businesses or to businesses that want to reach the green market, all sorts of cool and groovy stuff. And I just, again, want to say thank you, Harvey. It's you and I actually have met at a couple of national conferences on media reform, and it's just it was such a thrill to be on your radio show.
Well, we'll have you back as work at Montague Farm progresses. You guys let me know. I hope to come visit one of these days. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've been talking with Bill Jacobson and Shell Horowitz about Montague Hippie Farm and green marketing. Before that, we had Bob Alvarez talking about those radioactive tanks at Hanford. Next week, we'll be joined by Winona Howder to talk to us about food.
Into the ground, I started to burn many things.